Church bulletins sometimes have very strange things in them, odd misprints. And I saw one this week that I thought I should share with you. It announced that the sermon on Sunday evening would be entitled, "What is Hell Like?" And that was immediately followed by this invitation, "Come early and hear our choir practice." If I had a bad choir, I couldn't tell that. I don't intend to rehearse the whole history of a holiday this morning, but it may help to remember that the Thanksgiving Day we celebrate this week had its origin on this continent among those Congregationalist pilgrims who came on the Mayflower and were nearly wiped out in that first dreadful winter of 1920. When the following summer's corn crop was good, Governor William Bradford chose a day in mid-December to celebrate and give thanks. Indians brought wild turkey and venison. The pilgrim men provided wild geese, ducks, and fish, and the women boiled and baked and roasted meat, cornmeal bread, succotash. Dessert was pumpkin stewed in maple syrup. And for 3 days they ate, prayed, and sang, hailing the eternal mystery of planting and growth and harvest. I sometimes think it may be easier for people close to the land to be religious than it is for those in big cities. Country people are never really under the illusion that they are masters of their fate. Life there depends so much on sunshine and rain in the right amounts and at the right time. And while people are aware of that in cities, they're really mostly just reasons to go out with or without an umbrella. To the farmer, they are the motions of the hand of God. The Galilean rabbi we call Jesus was close to the country, and he used constantly the images of country life. One day when he was teaching in parables, he said what you have heard already this morning. The kingdom of God is like a man scattering seed on the ground and then going to bed each night and getting up every morning while the seed sprouts and grows up, though he has no idea how it happens. Emerson asked one time in one of his essays, "What is a farm but a mute gospel?" And he had in mind the mystery of growth from a seed in the soil and growth from the seeds of ideas planted in human hearts, of how quietly and without haste personality develops to surprise us who had gone to bed and gotten up through many nights and days without noticing what was happening. I've been thinking this past week about Thanksgiving in relation to the mystery of growth and the joy of harvest. As most of you know, I was in Oklahoma City last Sunday to christen a grandchild. My son had extended one of those warm and sensitive invitations that it's impossible to resist. He said, "Dad, all the people at Mayflower Church are wondering when the old one from the north is coming down to baptize the baby." So the old one went, and on Sunday before church, We all poked and jiggled the new grandchild every time he tried to fall asleep in the hope that he would slumber peacefully through the ceremony. You can probably guess how successful that was, but at least I had a microphone and he didn't. A few years from now, in the mystery of growth, this child will have learned how to behave in public. I know he will because I've seen that happen to his older brother and sister. Somebody who knows his older brother laughed already. Chelsea, whom we all used to call the Queen of Fidget because she couldn't keep her hands off anything in the house, couldn't stretch out beside you on the floor to watch TV without twisting and kicking constantly, now is growing slim and tall and elegant and self-possessed. And Blue, now almost 16, has shaved his head and put an earring in one ear in obedience to the dictates of current fashion. But he has also brought home his first grades from this year, 4 A's and 2 B's, unexpected to all of us, and to great giving of thanks in that household. I mean, this is the same boy who once opened the faucet of a 300-gallon holding tank in my basement to show off to his girl cousins and flooded the room, who spent the night in the guest house and broke the commode, who took everything apart that could be unscrewed or bent or broken, and who now turns out to be surprisingly gentle and helpful with his baby brother, never too busy to hold him, quite willing even to change diapers. What a miracle unfolds when people grow up. I have a friend in Dallas who is nationally recognized as the unofficial historian of Texas, author of 15 books or more, a guest many times on the McNeil-Lehrer Report. He called the other night on the occasion of his birthday to talk to me about his latest book and about some screenplays he had done and how the governor, you know her, had sent greetings along with friends like Larry McMurtry of Lonesome Dove fame. And when that conversation was over, I got to thinking about a day many years ago in Abilene, Texas, when A.C. Green and I were in our senior year of college, and how his mother and father, after they told him goodbye, came to my room and wept in despair because he was so cynical and restless and unfocused and had just been kicked out of our French class for making the kind of remark he was famous for in those days. "We're so afraid AC will never amount to anything," his mother told me. I would have fibbed if necessary in the name of love and comfort, but I didn't have to. I had sat up so many times talking with this friend until 3 and 4 in the morning in our dorm room that I had no doubt about his future. I begged his mom and dad not to worry, that someday they would be so proud of their son they wouldn't be able to believe they had ever worried. And they lived to find that out. But I understood their concern. From all outward appearances, their son was not exactly a promising seed. Have you ever traced the seeds that startled you into growth and changed your life? I walked into a bookstore in Wales one day, bought a book, and without knowing it at the time, without knowing it even after I had finished reading it, my whole life began to be transformed. Thousands of books before and after, all useful, but that one little book with its plain cover and cheap paper a seed with unbelievable force. It probably is no great exaggeration to say that I am here to enjoy this marvelous church because of that book. I have long since outgrown it, read better books, but for that moment and in that place, it was the necessary seed of a totally unpredictable harvest. How thankful I have been for what seemed at the time a minor lucky accident. Once during the week just past, I got to wondering where the spirit of gratitude got a start. When the very first human on this planet had the first dim thought of thankfulness, it must have come like a strange miniature comet into a head full of animal instinct and pure libido. Perhaps after a good hunt and a good meal, or sitting by a warm fire on a cold day, or in that delicious moment of feeling safe and dry inside the cave while the thunder booms outside and the rain pours down. Who knows? It might have been the moment when a child was born, and this time both it and its mother survived. Maybe it was no single one of any of those things, but all of them piled up through the years until in one magical moment, some long-forgotten biped counted up his blessings, blinked a tear from beady eyes, and had a thought. This good. And in that moment, in that strange, new, simple thought of thankfulness, religion was born. Because being grateful really is one of the first elementary steps out of the prison of self. And religion is possible only when self is no longer the universe. I held and watched an infant this weekend past. Beautiful little guy to look at, with a quick smile that could melt stone and bright, curious eyes, but not one ounce of sentient gratitude in that tiny head of his. The process of becoming a human being is barely underway with this child. When his stomach starts to contract, and it seemed to me that occurred with startling frequency, and he cries out from hunger pains, louder and louder until something happens, he doesn't care who provides lunch or whether providing it is convenient. And if his being satisfied meant that his mother would not live, he would nurse just as greedily and thoughtlessly as ever. Romanticize a baby all you like, but that's the truth. They are locked into the prison of self, and for years to come, their families try to make them fully human by getting them out of that prison, teaching them to say thank you and to mean it. That most basic of all confessions, that we are not responsible for everything, not in control of everything. We need somebody else. We grow up to discover not only the thing called gratitude, but that special holiday which celebrates it, Thanksgiving. I suppose it wouldn't be a bad idea as preparation for Thursday to remember what that day was like when most of you were children. In my home, everybody not spoken for by some other part of the extended family came to share our bounty in a sacramental meal. We polished the candlesticks, washed the old white plates with the thin gold bands, made an autumn centerpiece of apples and grapes and oranges, not just for decoration in those hard times, but to be eaten through the day. Dad's prayer at table was different from his usual routine, so I knew we were really setting up an altar to the Lord, mindful of His mercies, glad to share what we had. This doesn't happen much anymore, I suppose, but I even had more than just a gustatory interest in the turkey, because sometimes he had strutted around our yard for several weeks until I could barely look at him and think of his fate. Out of all the Thanksgivings that have come and gone, some are always special, and I share a couple of mine only in the hope that while I do it, you will find a couple of yours in the gallery of memories. I jump from childhood to a Thanksgiving in England when a family in Birmingham invited me down from Oxford for that American holiday and a chance to speak on Sunday in their little church. I knew how tough things would be for them, having gone through the Blitz, so I took what I could from our commissary to help with the meal. Mrs. Minton, the dear English lady of the house, received all of it gladly, except for two cans of corn. She was pleasant, but firm. Corn is fed to pigs, and no self-respecting English family she knew would be caught dead eating it. So we had her Thanksgiving meal, and it was good, except for something she called bubble and squeak, which our Dr. John and Pauline Danby can identify, and which started a civil war in my stomach that lasted for about 3 days. Then I went on down to London to Royal Albert Hall, where an English and American audience of 10,000 were to celebrate the American holiday. There was no hint that a famous person would be present. Even when we took the program at the door, his name had been left off because the Germans, it was thought, might deliberately drop bombs on the hall if they knew he was present. I had a good seat just above the royal box. I watched the king, long since dead, and the queen mother, still living, isn't she? Come into the box, and Margaret and Elizabeth, little girls then, and Prime Minister Clement Attlee. And suddenly there was a hush, and then a tremendous roar, and back at the very start of one long aisle appeared a familiar figure in his famous jumpsuit, with one hand up in a familiar V for victory salute, and the great round hall literally shook as Winston Churchill walked to the stage to tell young Americans like myself how much he and his people appreciated our being there, how thankful they were on that day of American Thanksgiving, a shining, unforgettable moment in my life. I've spent my life being thankful I got to come home from that particular journey because I had so many dear friends who didn't. Through all the years since, at public events with the national anthem and the flag, I have seen faces behind the flag. I can still see Bob Baker's face, the best high school cartoonist I ever met, who sat in front of me in homeroom and over whose shoulder I used to look with inordinate envy because I couldn't draw, and who now lies in the hold of the battleship Arizona under the waters at Pearl Harbor. Howard Hansen, left behind in a military cemetery in France. So many of them I could not call the roll. Why was I lucky? I have no idea, except that I have always felt I owed life something. And when I start to complain about something, I almost invariably find reason to be ashamed and grateful again for blessings. A young woman, who most of you do not know, called me the other day to ask if we could talk. I tried to guess what might be wrong because she sounded distressed. I didn't even come close. She has a happy-go-lucky little boy, about 4, who she discovered wasn't jumping like the other kids in the preschool games. She asked why, and a teacher said, "Oh, sometimes you have to teach kids to jump." And I'm not sure I believe that. I couldn't imagine it, and I think she couldn't either. The mother of this little boy, whose name is Ian. So she went to Heart Spring, where they did some tests and pronounced a tentative verdict, but suggested a full physical in the hospital. There were muscle biopsies and blood tests, and the guess was confirmed. Muscular dystrophy. With this prognosis, a slow deterioration of the little boy's muscles until by 10, he would be in a wheelchair all the time. And the heart muscle slowly failing too until death came around age 22. This mother's future, to share this child's pain as he realizes what a cruel trick life has played on him. And her only hope, that there will be a breakthrough to save him. Pray for her this week, and for Ian, and weep tears of gratitude that whatever has made you fretful this week is not as important after all as you thought. And wherever you are on Thursday, in your home or somebody else's, with loved ones around or by yourself, in words spoken while you hold hands around the table, or in the wordless silence of your heart, say, and mean it, thank you.